Now I will welcome the members of the panel up to the stage. Welcome Annika Söder, Executive Director of the Dag Hammarskjöld Foundation. She was previously the Undersecretary General of FAO, and before that, among things, State Secretary for Development Cooperation at the Swedish Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Also welcome Mr. Per Örnius. He is now the head of the Department for Multilateral Development Cooperation at the Swedish Ministry of Foreign Affairs. We also have the Norwegian Desmond McNeil here. He's a research director at the Center for Development, hi Desmond, and the Environment at the University of Oslo. And he has written several books about on multilateral organization. Welcome back also Rachel and Björn. Here you go. First, I'm curious, Per. We heard a lot about assessments, MOPEN and also the UK, the MAR assessment. How much do you look and follow, Per, the recommendations of the different kind of assessments?
Since we were one of the founders of MOPAN, we closely follow the developments of that network and its techniques, etc. And we do actually annually use the MOPAN evaluations or assessments in our assessments, which we have to do annually as a civil servant system, providing advice to the government on relevance, effectiveness, efficiency, and results of the different multilateral organizations that we provide core support to. But MOPAN is not the only tool, and MAR is a British tool. Evidently, it was said it's geared to British policy goals, and we are an independent kingdom here in Scandinavia, so we have our own policies on this. And I also have to underline that there are different independent evaluations floating around, and our work is also, as MFA, as government body, to be engaged, serious partners in board work, in the work in the boards of these organizations. And that is something that does not happen once or three times a year, but it's a continuous process. So if you, as the Swedish government, provides serious money to the core budgets of these organizations, in order to help them fulfill their own strategic plans that we have decided collectively in the boards, we have to be engaged and continuously work with this. And in this endeavor, we also work closely with our field operations in the Swedish system, SIDA staff in field embassies, our staff in Geneva, Rome, New York, etc., and with the networks of diplomatic contacts. So it's a continuous process of gearing these investments in the right direction.
But if you get back to assessments, since we have been talking to them, what have you done that MOPAN has had evaluation on? Have you changed anything? Could you give an example of Swedish multilateral aid change due to some kind of effectiveness assessments?
Yeah, well, I could say that the last years, the Swedish government has decreased its core support to UNDP. And I do not think one could attribute that to MOPAN or to Björn or anyone, but to a sentiment in the Swedish government that the focus of UNDP's work could be improved, and we could stimulate that by decreasing the core support, a political decision that is, in a way, based on assessments. Other examples would be, a few years ago, we halved the support to UNODC and to UN Habitat, if I remember correctly. And that was also based on an assessment that we were not really happy with the effectiveness of these organizations and the sort of governance structures, etc. So, of course, the core contribution decisions annually taken by the government, in a way, are really affected by different kinds of evaluations or assessments. But not only MOPAN, and there is no such thing as a black box. Those of us having spent time in the Stockholm School of Economics, remember the idea of having a black box where you put in, you have a formula and you put in some data and outcomes to optimal investment decision. There is no such thing in multilateral development or in any political system. It's a very complex system, and MOPAN and other evaluations are merely one or two or three inputs into difficult structures and different decision processes.
Britain seems to do very well with their MAR. Should Sweden have a MAR of their own? What do you think? Last short answer for that.
Well, in a way, we do have a system still with something called multistrategin for us, speaking Swedish, which actually forces us in the government offices to make annual assessments based on MOPAN or other individual independent evaluations, and in a way cluster and reflect on efficiency, relevance, effectiveness. But plotting it in a scheme like that, comparing apples and bicycles, is not really, at least for now, an idea for the Swedish government.
If we go to Norway, Desmond, what is the story of Norway here?
Well, I think Norway, like in terms of multilateral, well, in terms of aid generally, what's quite interesting, I think, is that for the last 20 years, this support for aid has been between 80% to 90%, and yet the percentage of people who believe that aid works has gone down from 70% to 60% to 50%. And I think that's quite interesting because I interpret that to say that yeah, we think that we've got to do it, even though we're increasingly doubtful about whether it works. And I think that is a very realistic assessment of the situation, which is why I'm a bit sceptical that there's increasing mania for measurement and evidence. I mean, we have to accept that for 50 years we've been trying to find out if aid works, and we don't know. We had, does aid work, does aid barely work? As you mentioned, who was it, the Global Fund, 18 months, 20, and we still don't know. So at some point you have to say, enough, you know, let's look at, let's set aside. We got the evidence, good, excellent, thank you very much. We can go on looking at the sort of day-to-day efficiency of running the office, but we need actually to turn our attention to the sort of issues that Helen Milner was picking up on about control. It's about control, and let's look at the politics of it and the structure issues and recognize the way that decisions are really taken. And also, I think, turn things around. All the focus, this is yet another layer of control. As you rightly said, you have the board, and then suddenly here's another outside influence putting more pressure on, with the bilaterals, which, again, Helen quite rightly said, both in theory and empirically, are not as good as the multilaterals. The bilaterals are evaluating the multilaterals. This should be the other way around. The multilaterals say, well, how about the bilaterals? We know that they're pretty incompetent. Let's look at them in the same terms and try and change it around so that instead of the multilaterals being a complement to DFID, DFID becomes a complement to the multilaterals. In theory, everybody agrees about the MDGs, what we're meant to be doing, right? So let the multilaterals do that, and then let the bilaterals be a complement where they have special interests in this country or that activity. So logically, rationally, it should be the multilaterals that are getting most of the money, 70% say, and let the other 30% be used for special interests, special sectors, special concerns.
But the trend seems to be the other way around now. So what can affect...
In Norway, it hasn't changed much. I mean, it's interesting, the statistic, you know, these are the latest statistics from NORAD, they differ from the statistics that are quoted here, but multilateral has stayed fairly constant, about 50% in total, of which 50% is core funding. That's been... What varies a bit is the balance between UN and World Bank, to put it crudely. And again, they're faced with the same issue, I guess, as Sweden are. You know, they like the UN, on the other hand, the World Bank delivers, right? So what do you do? And that was particularly relevant to the previous government, where they were ideologically committed to supporting the UN, but in practice they became increasingly convinced that the World Bank was more efficient, and so they gradually moved away. With the new government, they'll probably be slightly more World Bank-oriented. In fact, they've already cut UNDP a bit.
Annika Söder, we have heard here that the trust in the UN has gone down, and people want to control, the countries want to control, and earmark money. How does that affect, do you think, those big multilateral institutions?
It obviously leads to a situation where the core activities of the funds and programs of the United Nations, for example, has to be paid by fewer and fewer, while you see big chunks of money coming into those organizations earmarked, and donors expect those money to be sort of the maintenance of that money be paid by others. But the trust issue is basically political, and I think what we see is a situation where we have a power shift in the world from state actors to non-state actors and from some state actors to other state actors. So we see an unwillingness of changing the way we work and an interest in controlling the multilateral institutions. And I find it fascinating that today we have no UN representative here. Some of us have worked in the UN, but no one is representing the UN here. We have no one from the so-called recipient or partner countries here discussing the effects. And I find that telling that this is the taxpayer money discussion. It's not really the discussion of long-term results.
But that might be the discussion this is a series of seminars. I got your point.
Maybe, I think we have to understand the multilateral context, that this is the gel of the world. We may need this gel more than ever. We need to know together with different countries, middle-income countries, poor countries, that the work we do together in the World Bank or in a regional bank or in the UN's 40 or more agencies, that it leads to a better situation. So we need to assess this together through the boards, as Per was saying, and to use the convening power of the multilateral institutions to do something together. I fully accept that we need to know what happens to our money, no matter where we are. But we have to understand that long-term results cannot be attributed to an individual actor. While we can assess if we're doing the right things, operational efficiency and management and governance, that was mentioned by Leonard earlier, we have to understand how complex this is. And when we work on assessments, try to do it as little cumbersome as possible for those that are actors, like UN agencies or the bank, and as pertinent and important as possible for those that actually are dependent on action.
Rachel, did you ask the people who are dependent on the UK action?
Did we ask beneficiaries and countries in the MAR? No, but we did try and get that evidence in through our country officers, who consulted with their colleagues and fed back to us. We also made quite a lot of effort to get NGOs to feedback about the performance in countries. And I know that because at the start of the MAR update process, I was working for an NGO, International Medical Corps, providing that feedback. So I also know we can do it a lot better the next time round because it wasn't very easy. But I just think there's so much more we can do, and we can do a lot better on that.
But what do you think about this, what Annika said just now, about the big organizations and the problems when you ask those specific questions of cost effectiveness or value for money, when you concentrate on that?
When we ask those questions, it's because we have to as donors, as Annika knows. I'm sorry, I'm not sure exactly
what I just wanted to do your reflections on what she said.
I just think these are important questions to ask if you're a donor. Ultimately, these are political decisions that are made about the use of taxpayers' money, and the questions that are constantly asked are around what are we getting for the money and how do we know where it's going. And I think there is a public accountability question. There is also a strong question about the value of aid and the very good points that Helen was making this morning about the value of multilateralism overall, and I think we don't bring those arguments forward enough. But the key accountability questions we are asked all the time by our parliament is what we're getting for the money.
I want to underline that I agree on transparency, accountability, value for money, but I think it's a matter of who is actually assessing and how we are evaluating the results, involving others and making their transaction costs as limited as possible. And I think in a world that is changing, we create a lot of distrust between different actors and new donors like China, India, and so on, if we continue the traditional donors not to reach out and find new methods of taking the global challenges on. And let me also remind all of us about the UN actually being founded on assessed contributions, where we still pay assessed contributions, where the idea was that everyone should make an investment, a small one for a poor country and a bigger one for the bigger countries, in order to create activities built on solidarity and to deal with problems. And I think that the world has now come back to a situation where most countries are equal, like they were after the Second World War, 50 countries, and where there is reason and maybe also possibility to work together in a new way with replenishments, with more assessed contribution and so on, because we have so many big challenges ahead of us. And then also the evaluations, the assessments and so on will have to be done on the results and together.
Björn. Yeah, your comment on this. Together. You have 17 countries now. Should you involve more countries in the assessments in order to be together?
All right, so there's several facets here. I think one is to what extent do we pick up on the voices of the beneficiaries?
Mm-hmm.
And that MOPAN tries to do through the survey. And the survey is indeed at the country level, with the beneficiary, the civil society, and with government representatives. So we try to capture that. And that's obviously that's an important part of our reform, is to, are we doing it appropriately, sufficiently? Can we do it more? But it's a tricky one. It's a hard methodologically, it's a hard thing to design well. And then I think the other dimension of your question is MOPAN with its exclusive DAC membership,
mm-hmm.
is that the appropriate? Does that reflect the new world? And obviously it doesn't. Should there be an openness within the network to include these new big actors, the Chinas, the Mexicos, Brazil, India, and also, as I was indicating, some of the global funds now have a governance structure which is member states, yes, civil society also. And you know, both Gavi and the Global Fund have a private sector and civil society representative. Could one imagine a MOPAN with those kind of members?
Yeah. What do you think?
It's up to my membership to think.
Yeah, but what do you think? Would that be good for MOPAN, do you think, to include those?
I mean, let me put it up as a question to the membership, and I think that's something that they will have to think about in the coming years.
Okay, Desmond, and then maybe Per.
On the point of assessing the impact of different multilateral organisations in country, you said it's a tricky one. I say it's an impossible one, and I think, I mean, your point is valid. And as you know, if we spent 18 months and 20 million, and we still don't know the answer of a fairly specific focused fund, I mean, we have to accept that it's impossible. We have to say, okay, we've got some useful numbers, and now let's get on and look at other questions, which are hugely important structurally if we want to improve the system. I think we have to be more realistic about the limitations of evaluation.
So should we have one evaluation for everything, except all those? You have so many now. Per talked about several, and you have yours, and then we have MOPAN, and then we have several others. What do you think, Per? Would that be good?
I'm an enemy of monolithic systems, so I think that we should let 1,000 flowers blossom. And I think, regarding the question of expanding MOPAN, MOPAN is a project with some 10 countries, now 17, and eventually tomorrow 25, trying just to come together to have a common methodology for assessments. And it's very cumbersome, and it has taken a lot of effort, energy, to get Björn's office in place and four staff in Paris with a housing arrangement at DAC. If we should expand this and make this something else, we could go to the, ECOSOC, the board of UNDP. I mean, there are different foras. We should not say, well, let's expand the MOPAN tool to the great monolithic answer to all questions. I don't believe in that. I think MOPAN has a very, very strong role and an important role to play, and we should see to that the toolbox of MOPAN is improved, really, really improved in the coming, say, 3 years. And we will have something that not only the 17 member states will look at, but possibly the rest of the world, but try to make it simple and try to make it work.
So why wouldn't it be good to not let all those thousand and thousand of the assessments flower? I mean, at least for the receiving countries, the beneficiaries. Wouldn't that be good that we can have one assessment, one big one? So you don't have to ask them to change, and then MOPAN has to ask them to change, and then you have to ask them to change in a specific way?
The change of organizations, improvement is sort of, this has to do with democracy and governance structures, and these bodies, they have boards, and the United Nations have a General Assembly, and we have to sort of respect that. Then we can have assessments, and rather have two or three assessments than only one. I think that's fairly obvious. That's at least the way I look at the world. I rather...
Two or three rather than one. Annika.
Opinions.
There is also a United Nations system-wide evaluation arrangement that is working as well, and one of the UNDP evaluations got headlines here in Sweden several months ago, and what they did was that they were trying to assess the multidimensional aspects of poverty, and they couldn't assess that. They could assess improvements in the work that had been conducted, but not a very particular advanced aspect of poverty reduction, and that went totally wrong in the Swedish media, but this is an example of how very ambitious and good evaluations are actually being conducted in the system. But let me also give a very bad example. I used to work in FAO, the Food and Agriculture.
You were not good on the list, on Rachel's list. You were
sort of on the
shit part of it. Yeah.
Yes. And actually that MAR evaluation had been made a few years after the biggest evaluation of an organization in UN's history. And it was a very ambitious and good evaluation. But member states did not fully own this evaluation, though they had decided upon it. So it wasn't really implemented. Mm. So you can pay a lot for evaluations. But if they're not owned well, they will not be carried out. And this happened in FAO, to my deep regret. And I was very frustrated when I worked there and saw this lack of way forward in improving FAO, despite many, many good colleagues and knowledgeable colleagues working there. So there are very good examples that we are not aware of, like ambitious evaluations where learning is actually taking place, and also evaluations that do not really lead to the expected results, basically because of member states maneuvering around evaluations results, in this case at least.
So if we go back to the trend of the multi-buy aid, I mean, earmarked money going to multilateral organizations, that has become an increasing trend, according to many of you now. How, if this is not good for the multilateral organizations, how do you affect this trend to change, to get more trust, other than just sitting in the boards that we have been talking about? Is there a way for the trend to change? What do you think, Desmond?
I think it is a very unfortunate trend because it's weakening the autonomy of the multilateral organisations, certainly. But I think it has to be treated head on, I think, rather than, you know, you're not going to get there by more evaluations and more evidence. I think you need a basic discussion in the multilateral system. And the question there is, you know, who is going to, has it fight back, as it were? That's the problem. Again, we've seen a sort of imbalance between the bilaterals and the multilaterals here. The bilaterals are doing all the evaluating, all the judging, and saying, we'll give you more money and you less money. We need somehow for the multilaterals, maybe together in concert, to come back and say, look, let's look at the structural system. It's in the interest of all the multilaterals, actually, to resist multi-buy. But each individual one, they want it, right? Because that's the way they're getting extra money. So I think you need some concerted action to balance the politics of it between the bilaterals and the multilaterals. Mm.
Because in the end of the day, we ask ourselves, I mean, what is the best way to use the money to combat poverty? So how should donor countries then reason around this, do you think? What is the best advice you can give today, Rachel?
It's to look at the evidence. I mean, we say that we don't We don't have an ideal split between our multilateral spend and our bilateral spend, and that's true. The percentage, it's around 42%, and it varies around that over the last 10 years, is a result of a lot of different decisions, and our aim is to make those each decision in the best possible way. So are we funding the right multilaterals for what we're trying to achieve as DFID? In countries, this question of non-core spending, we're still looking at our trend information on that, but a lot of our non-core multi-buy spending in country is in fragile states where we're looking for implementing partners, and there aren't very many implementing partners. Quite a lot of them are multilateral agencies or UN agencies like UNDP. So we give money to UNDP to implement for us in places where there aren't many other partners to choose from, and they're the best partner available. And it's that kind of decision which gives rise to these things which are trends. But I think it's a mistake for us, at least, to look at the trend as if it's an explicit decision. It's not. It's a result of a lot of very different very different decisions, and in a world where we're both increasing our spend but increasing our focus on fragile states.
So you say, look at the evidence. Björn, what is the best way, do you think, in the end of the day, for a donor country, which is our focus today, to spend money in order to really combat poverty, having said all this?
That's a big question, no? Mm-hmm. Very big question.
Yeah. Well, you have a minute or so. Your best advice, then.
Personal question, and I sort of think that the exercises that both the MAR and we're doing within MOPAN, in terms of collecting evidence, collecting data, and engaging in this and supporting an informed dialogue, because I think it's very much about that. That's what the information that we generate is for our members to have that dialogue.
Informed dialogue, I'm writing down it. I'm going over to the government later on. Yes, Desmond.
I mean, firstly, I think we all the evidence so far we've heard is about the multilaterals. Let's have some critical evidence about the bilaterals. And then secondly, let's use the evidence. I mean, there's one thing to produce the evidence, but the other thing is to use it in a serious debate. Going back to Helen's talk, theoretically, empirically, multilaterals are better. Let's use that evidence to have a debate and a criticism of the bilaterals for doing too much buy and multi-buy aid.
To use the evidence. Per and then Annika, last word.
I think really one has to ask what the true value added of, let's say, the United Nations development system is. And I would be as provocative as to say that I don't think the best value is service provision in technical terms. If one is to distribute bed nets in the poor parts of India, maybe Coca-Cola Company or Wayne's Coffee might be better suited to do that. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to building norms and to working with policy and what Lennart referred to as the political dimension of global development challenges, we just have one United Nations, and we have to deal with that. And somewhere this morning, we have sort of try to create a conflict between core, non-core, and bilateral. That's really strange, because I think that these tools are mutually supportive. And it is a problem that today UNDP has, 85% of its budget non-core. How on earth can you have some flexibility? It's impossible. So we have to sort of get this into a nice balance in order to create a collective effort for efficiency in the global system.
Annika.
If you really believe that we should make this world survive, go for UN reform. Try it out in different ways. I know the Swedish government is supporting a replenishment system in WHO so that non-core and core will play less of a role. In my foundation, we're creating space in the spirit of Dag Hammarskjöld, and we've started a process on UN development system reform in the spirit that Per mentioned, also on making the best use of the multilateral system to actually deal with the key issues and to see to it that the UN is used less for service delivery. And here we have a dilemma because we've said that ODA should go to the field and to the poorest and yeah. so on. But now, with a more leveled world, we may need to put more money into implementing conventions, rules, and regulations in middle-income countries and in poor countries, more policy work, more upstream work.
But that's harder
and
to
that
assess.
Can be measured.
Yeah, that's harder to assess value for money. Yeah.
Even if the Millennium Development Goals are not perfect. Let's hope that the new post-2015 agenda that hopefully the member states of the UN will decide upon in 1.5 years, that will constitute a measurement where we can assess ourselves both universally on important matters that concern all of us and nationally when it comes to progress in different fields of development.
Desmond, you wanted to say something. No, you're not waving. This is nice and important words, Annika, but what is needed in order for the politicians to accept that this is the most important way to go?
You ask the politicians.
Well, you're next one, huh?
Well, I think the realization about the interdependence, the changes going on is very big, and not least in civil society around the globe. And you can see how civil society and other external stakeholders come together. Also, actually, private actors like Gates. And I guess the WHO cannot be that bad if Gates is the
the
one
major.
Of the main contributors, since he's a real businessman. But I mean, it's the same response as always when it comes to politics. It's about arguing. It's about creating groups to put pressure on actors. Mm. I think Europe is in a situation where it's hard for yeah. Europe to actually take a long-term view. But let's hope that changes.
I was just going to add that the MDGs were, you know, very much numbers-oriented and goals-oriented. And what looks like the debate around the MDGs 2015 is they're actually widening the debate a bit and the Sustainable Development Goals and so on. So a sort of optimistic view is to think that the MDGs 2015 will not just be new numbers. They will be, in addition, some taking up some of these structural issues and maybe some commitments of a more structural nature, not just 50% of that or 70%, but some commitments to changing the relationship between different countries within.
Thank you, and thank you for being part of the debate today. An applause.